Let us pray, friends. Our Father in heaven, thank you for the family that came and observed today. And I pray that you'll bless them in their education, whether in this program or some other. Thank you for the freedom to vote today. I pray that you'll help us to do so and that you'll grant by that process a wise government for us. So grateful that you're allowing us to be here and taking this material together. We're grateful for what you've done for us to grant us the amazing religious liberty that we have now, and pray that you'll help us learn enough about how you've done that to give you the glory and to think rightly about such things in our generation. In the name of Jesus, amen. Friends and neighbors, the quiz, the old quiz. You know that when you see ye in old print, it's not really ye. They didn't really say ye. It's the word thee. It was just a little printing shortcut. But it's fun to say ye old whatever. Let me confess a little bit. I have had more trouble getting ready for class today than usual, because my internet service was still out at my house today, and all my everything I do is on the internet for this class, so I had some trouble getting class ready. If I seem to not know what I'm talking about worse than usual, you can blame it on that, okay? A simple five-question quiz, just to check on, make a little check to make sure you're doing your reading and reviewing your class notes. Question number one. What is the two-word phrase I used in last week's lecture, 2 weeks ago, lecture, for the compromise religious policy in the Church of England in the second half of the 16th century? What's that two-word phrase I kept using for the compromise religious policy in the Church of England? Question number two from your reading in this book. Who was that most famous English pirate captain who repeatedly fought the Spanish in the 1500s and was the first Englishman to see the Pacific Ocean? Question number three. When Spain in the 1500s was almost exclusively Roman Catholic, what country that Spain ruled over was fighting to maintain the Reformed or Protestant faith? When Spain was almost exclusively Roman Catholic in the 1500s, what country that Spain ruled over was fighting to maintain the Reformed or Protestant faith? Question number four. In what country were the Protestants called the Huguenots? Now, of course, no French-speaking person ever said Huguenot, you know. But it is well established that English-speaking people like us just say Huguenot. You don't have to attempt to say a Huguenot or whatever those people themselves would have said, okay? In what country were the Protestants called the Huguenots? What was the name of the King of Spain who was England's antagonist in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I? What was the name of the King of Spain who was England's antagonist in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I? Okay, the correct answers? That two-word phrase?
Elizabethan settlement.
The Elizabethan settlement, yes. That most famous English pirate captain?
Sir Francis Drake.
Yes. What country was Spain ruling over that was fighting to remain Protestant?
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands. In what country were the Protestants called the Huguenots?
France.
In France. And who was the main bad guy?
King Philip.
King Philip. And he was King Philip II, wasn't he? Okay. Would you please... Would you please say for me every item in your official timeline? And I guess what we'll do is... I thought some fun thoughts about bringing a deck of cards or something, and then I forgot all about them. So let me see if we can come up with some interesting way to go about this. All right. I'll choose somebody to say one of them, and then that person will choose the next person, and so on. And no person... What?
Can you choose yourself?
A person may not choose himself, nor may he choose someone who already has been chosen until everyone has been. Okay.
So we're doing it until the whole timeline?
So you've said the whole timeline. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for today is to say this class's timeline and last... No, just kidding. All right, Ava, you go first. You say the first one and then choose the next victim.
1509, King Henry VIII ascends the throne of England. Angie.
1526, Tyndale's Complete New Testament in English is printed.
And so that's interesting you should say it that way. On accident, you said in England, which it wasn't, right? It was in English, but not in England. Right, okay.
Audrey.
1534, the Act of Supremacy officially separates the Church of England from the Pope. Albert.
1547, King Edward VI ascends the throne of England.
Is that right, everybody?
It's ascends the throne, though, I think.
We decided that the of England was optional after that. All right, so you get to choose the next victim and you don't have to... It doesn't
Angie.
Have...
1553, Queen Mary I ascends the throne. Oh, I have to do something else.
You have to pick the next victim.
1558, Queen Elizabeth I ascends the throne.
They have to pick the next victim.
Audrey. 1560, the new Bible is published.
Do we have any more, or is that it so far? The new one, congratulations, very nicely done. The new one for today is 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated. That was a bit of a spoiler, wasn't it? 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated. I thought about saying the Spanish Armada is defeated, but I have two reasons why I didn't put that. One, we already have items in before that in our timeline that don't have a definite article. Also, that is not the only Spanish Armada, not the only one to be defeated. So, I'm just going to leave it without the definite article. 1588, Spanish Armada is defeated. Let's read some Bible verses for today. Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14, I believe all four of you got equal opportunity during the timeline, didn't you? So let's have you, Angie, and you, Alvin, read us these two verses, Exodus 14, 26 and 27.
Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen."
And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. And when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea.
Amen. You read there about a miracle in which the Lord, by his mighty hand, brought Israel out of Egypt and defeated the Egyptians who were chasing them. And that is not exactly what happened in the matter of the 1588 Spanish Armada. But it kind of rings the same note that God, whenever he is pleased to, throws down whatever powerful military force he wants to accomplish his purposes. And you know, it's not that the people of Israel were all sinless, righteous, faithful people. You know, most of them, not very long after this, would be dancing around the golden calf that they had made. You know, it's that God saves whom he's pleased to save and destroys whom he's pleased to destroy. No number of chariots can survive being inundated by the Red Sea when God's doing it, you know, and no number of ships can withstand his power when he chooses to exert it. Doesn't mean that the beneficiaries are all faithful Christians. Doesn't mean that those who are defeated are all wicked unbelievers. But God has decreed all the good things he's going to do, and he does them. So let's talk about some of that. We left off a couple of weeks ago in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. We talked through the Elizabethan settlement, of course, the attempts on both sides to try to unsettle that settlement, because basically nobody was happy with it. And the Roman Catholics, you know, did this and this to try to unsettle it. And she and her government did this and this to try to counter those moves. The Protestants did this and this to try to unsettle it. And she and her government had to do this and this to counter those moves. And really the biggest event in all of that, where the Roman Catholics were trying to unsettle the Elizabethan settlement, was the events around the Spanish Armada of 1588. Now, you remember Mary, Queen of Scots, Roman Catholic, who had to flee from Scotland after her boyfriend unsuccessfully tried to blow up her husband and then murdered him in the backyard when he couldn't blow him up in the house. And she was deposed and fled and sought refuge with Elizabeth, who did give her refuge, but kept her locked up too, not in prison, but kept her in custody. And and there was a constant or a recurring instance of people conspiring to try to kill Elizabeth, enthrone Queen Mary, return the country to Catholicism and to the Pope. Finally, 1587, Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed for treason.
Had she really committed treason?
The author of our textbook says that she did, and I don't know much more about that. So I'll refer you to the author's statement, and then beyond that, you've got to look it up for yourself. I have the book handy here, and I think I can put my finger on what our author said pretty easily. It says here, this brings us to the last chapter in the life of the unfortunate Queen of Scots. Mary had been moved from castle to castle. The cold, bleak air of one of these, Sheffield Castle, told on her health, and she suffered great pain from acute rheumatism. To the end of her life, she remained stiff and lame from rheumatic pains. She had been continually begging Elizabeth to grant her freedom, yet all the time she was corresponding somehow with her Catholic friend, the Duke of Norfolk, in order to effect her escape from her long imprisonment. The Duke of Norfolk was now executed. Mary was accused of plotting against Elizabeth. And then, the rest of the story is soon told. Mary was tried in the great hall of Fotheringay Castle, declared guilty, and executed. A very outburst of horror at the deed arose over Europe. So I might have given an inaccurate account. This author says that she was corresponding with the Duke of Norfolk to effect her escape. So she doesn't exactly say that she was corresponding with him to effect a coup d'etat or anything. So she and he finally were executed. So Mary, Queen of Scots, being executed for treason was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back or something, or the offense that made it gave the political cover or religious rationale or something for King Philip to go ahead with an attempted invasion. And so his preparations were underway in 1587. The Armada actually set out in 1588. Now I'm going to do some reading from the chapter on the Spanish Armada in our little textbook. It seems very good to me. For most of today, when I was trying to look at my notes from last time, like I told you, I couldn't get to them. And so I thought all I had at my disposal was this chapter. That's funny. Well, I guess I do again. I brought along my notes that had finally come up on my phone, but now they don't want to come up again. But that'll work out well. Then that'll help me decide which thing to make more reference to. So I'll make more reference to the textbook. Excuse me just a sec. Like I told you, I'm having more than the usual amount of trouble here, but I think we'll still do okay. You read about the sea rovers, the unofficially authorized pirates who were going around and giving trouble to the King of Spain's ships everywhere. So there was the matter of the Protestant, or, you know, in their view, you know, heretic Queen Elizabeth, and how she had executed the Roman Catholic Mary, Queen of Scots. Remember also that King Philip used to be King of England when Bloody Mary, his wife, was still alive. And so for these various, and then also the Queen Elizabeth and various other powerful Englishmen were aiding the Dutch in their resistance to Roman Catholicism being imposed on them by Spain. For all of these reasons, King Philip finally decided to take drastic measures. I'm going to read now from our textbook. Philip of Spain continued his preparations for invading England. He felt that the conquest of Elizabeth's kingdom would enable him to complete his triumph over the obstinate people of the Netherlands. His warlike plans were known to all. The essence of his plan was to equip a large fleet of ships in Spain, their main Atlantic port being Cadiz, C-A-D-I-Z, and then sail to the Netherlands and embark the bulk of his army that was in the Netherlands fighting to suppress the Protestants. The army being about 30,000 strong. And his large armada would transport them across the narrow English Channel and land them in the south of England, not far from London. And with that army, he would liberate the subjects of Queen Elizabeth from her awful heretical rule and restore them to the true Roman Catholic faith and allegiance to the Pope. King Philip appointed a nobleman to be in charge of this enterprise, the Duke of Medina Sidonia. The Duke of Medina Sidonia, who was not a sailor at all, not an experienced navy commander, but apparently was a very capable, respected, and loyal person, who, by all accounts, did an amazing, fantastic job of establishing and equipping the force that would be the Armada. He organized it, apparently, extremely well. Now, here's what our textbook says about this in the context of Drake's voyage to go harass and reconnoiter that fleet. Drake started off on a new enterprise with some 25 ships supplied by merchant adventurers, 4 supplied by the Queen. He went off in 1587 to divide the gathering fleet of Spain and, if possible, to stop its supply of food. Elizabeth gave her consent. Drake was hurrying to Cadiz, where he found Spanish preparation already well advanced. Now here's a quote from Drake. "The like preparation was never heard of nor known, as the King of Spain hath to invade England. His provisions of bread and wines are so great as will suffice 40,000 men for a whole year." The English sea rover was soon at his old work, and his exploits in Cadiz Harbor made the world ring with admiration of his daring. He sank great Spanish galleons. He burnt large vessels laden with biscuits and wine. He created terror among the Spanish seamen and discovered for his country the strength of the foe. Quote, "I have singed the King of Spain's beard," unquote, he said on his return home. And he had done more than that. He had stimulated the Spanish to still greater effort for the overthrow of England. Philip was now irritated beyond endurance, and he put out all his strength to accomplish his life's desire and defeat of England. While his ships were getting ready to sail, see how England was preparing for this great ordeal. Now there's the interesting account here of the calling out of the country's militia during the time that the Armada was fitting out and about to sail. Before Elizabeth's reign, in the time when, ironically, Philip and Mary were ruling England, a new system had been imposed for calling out the militia. We've learned together before the important concept of the militia, which is essentially all of the able-bodied men able to bear arms, and not counting those who are organized into a permanent army, but those who normally go about their own business and are called up from time to time. And so a new system was imposed for organizing them. And when the armada was expected and Queen Elizabeth called for the militia to come out, the system worked very well. And the people's loyalty to Elizabeth was shown. This call-up did not show England to be divided in loyalty. The Roman Catholics not wanting to serve Elizabeth. It wasn't like that. The able-bodied men of the whole country turned out quickly and in great numbers, so that nearly 100,000 men in arms responded to the call-up. It was a huge, amazing thing that had there had never been such a military turnout before in any of England's wars. And Queen Elizabeth went and reviewed the troops herself in person. Here's an interesting thing that your textbook recounts. The representatives from the city of London asked the queen, "How many men and ships must we provide?" And the answer was 5,000 men and 15 ships. But 2 days later, 10,000 men and 30 ships were produced by the city of London and placed at the queen's disposal. The queen herself reviewed her land forces. The troops assembled at Tilbury in great spirits, longing to fight the Spaniards. And Elizabeth appeared wearing armor and without any sort of bonnet or anything, bareheaded so that everyone could see her well. You remember from our first introduction, a few introductory lines about Elizabeth, she was a very accomplished young lady in several things when she came to the throne, including she was a good rider. So she appeared horseback, and your textbook here says she was mounted on a war horse in a breastplate with a general's truncheon in her hand. She was very, very well received and cheered, and she gave a speech. Here's a little bit of it. "My loving people, let tyrants fear. I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. Therefore I am come amongst you at this time, for I am resolved in the midst of heat and battle to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people my honor and my blood even in the dust. I know that I have but the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart of a king and a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Spain should dare to invade the borders of my realm. Rather than any dishonor to the kingdom should come by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general. I do not doubt but your obedience to my general and your valor in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory over the enemies of my God, of my kingdom, and of my people." So interestingly, that huge force of militia turned out and never fired a shot. There was never land warfare in England at that time. So it was apparently a glorious moment for the people and the queen and their relationship and their loyalty and all of that, a great national show of unity, but was not actually then part of the actual military events. Now, the Armada was composed of about 25 great warships, very large, with very large contingents of soldiers on each ship, and then about then there was a total of 151 ships, because there were also, in addition to the warships, there were many converted merchant vessels carrying soldiers, carrying supplies, lightly armed. There were about 8,000 sailors and about 18,000 soldiers. There were about 2,500 cannons, and I don't mean that's how many were on the ships. As I understand, that's the cargo of cannons for the army once it's landed in England. And in the Netherlands was a Spanish army of about 30,000. So in addition to the 18,000 aboard ship, they were going to pick up another 30,000 to take them across. I think there were barges to carry the soldiers across the channel. So it was a 151 ships, 25 or so large warships. And the English fleet had 34 warships and many other miscellaneous smaller ships, for a total of about 200. But they were all so much smaller and so much more lightly armed, with so many fewer soldiers aboard, that the Spanish Armada was still much more powerful in firepower and manpower. I think I'll come up to the marker board. You all might come over there with me. And I'm going to draw you a precise replica of the coast of England and France and the Netherlands, okay? Okay. Here is an exact replica of the south of England. Okay? And I include this right here, it's an island. And then this right here is an exact replica of the coast of Europe. You recognize that, of course. So the Spanish Armada approached from the south and was spotted and their presence reported to the English fleet at Portsmouth. You recognize that slightly mushroom-shaped blob I drew as an exact replica of the harbor at Portsmouth. At the time that Spanish Armada was approaching, the tide was going in, and the way the sailing ships at that time were, they couldn't leave port with the tide coming in. There's a famous account of the commanding admiral, Lord Howard, and the vice admiral, Sir Francis Drake, playing some game, and it was reported that the Spanish were approaching. But Drake knew the winds and the tides and the speed of everything so well that he knew they couldn't do anything at the moment anyway, and that the Spanish, though they had been spotted, weren't going to actually be there for so many hours. He knew all those calculations. So by the time they got close and spotted Portsmouth, the tide was going out and the English came out and fought them in this vicinity, so that the Spanish had to abandon plans of attacking and landing at Portsmouth. They then turned east and were harassed by the English all the way across. The armada was formed into a great crescent like this, the most powerful warships being at the horns of the crescent, causing it to be where the English fleet had a very hard time getting to any serious attack on those vessels that were carrying the supplies and the soldiers and everything. The Spanish ships were very heavily armed with weapons that were useful only at very short range. The English were less heavily armed, but a number of their guns could shoot farther. So for these first couple of days, the English would stay at long range and delivered a lot of fire, but not to any serious damage to the armada. The armada lost a couple of ships that collided, but no serious damage. This right here is an exact representation of the Isle of Wight. Very large island off southern England, the Isle of Wight. And this channel right here, the English call the Solent. And an excellent move for the Spanish Armada would have been to enter the Solent and land on the Isle of Wight, and then be able from there to offer to threaten England in a number of ways. The British fleet perceived that and maneuvered into this area and fought the Spanish here, so that the Armada could not enter the Solent and land on the Isle of Wight. And the Armada continued in this direction. The Armada was trying to send word to the 30,000, to the commander of the King of Spain's 30,000 troops, was trying to send word for them to be ready to embark. But they had no way of sending a message any faster than they were traveling. So the word never reached them. The Armada finally made harbor. Word was sent to the Spanish commander. Several days of preparations were needed to get the 30,000 embarked and ready to cross. The Armada kept their tight crescent formation in harbor. Thus, the English fleet, under Howard and Drake, had no way to sail in and do any harm to the armada formed like they were. So they decided to break up the armada with fire ships. They took 8 ships, covered them with tar and loaded them with gunpowder, rigged the sails and the rudder to go in the right direction, and sent 8 fire ships in the middle of the night into the armada in its tightly packed formation. It was apparently terrifying. Wooden ships, fire, their biggest threat. Some of the most disciplined captains of the actual warships kept their cool. Most of the captains of the vessels of the armada panicked and called for the anchors to be cut so that the ships immediately could get underway and avoid the fire ships. Weighing anchor is a time-consuming process. You have to first get enough sailors, you know, ready, and then it's a big, you know, heavy thing. They have to work machinery to get it to come up. It takes several minutes. And so most of the ships cut the rope that holds the anchor, let the anchors fall away, and sailed quickly out. There was a south wind, so they easily sailed northward. The fire ships did not do much damage to the armada, but the armada was scattered. It completely lost its defensive crescent formation, plus most of the ships were now without their main anchors. The next day, at a place known as Gravelines, the Spanish fleet and the English fleet fought. And this time, the Spanish fleet did not have its well-disciplined crescent formation. The English did lots of damage to the Spanish ships. Several were sunk or grounded. And they kept fighting until the English had no ammunition left. And then the English fleet withdrew, and the Spanish commander, the Duke of Medina Sidonia, not being a sailor, ordered a plan that no one expert in sailing these seas would have ever, you know, could ever have ordered. He ordered that the armada, the ships, had essentially been so damaged, so many of them lost and everything, that now the plan to land everything with these, take these 30,000, land everything in England, conquer London, all of that, was abandoned. And it was just a matter of how are we going to get resupplied, how are we going to get back home. Coming all the way back through the English Channel, being fought by that British fleet all the way back, the British could go back in at any of several places and resupply with more gunpowder and shot. The Spanish couldn't. The Spanish commander ordered that this armada sail north, go north of Scotland, and come down west of Ireland and go back to Spain. They didn't have sufficient supplies for that length of journey, even if it went well. Most of the fleet didn't have the seafaring skills in the stormy North Sea areas to do any of that, but that's what was ordered. There was a strong north wind at the same time that this decision needed to be, a strong south wind. Winds are named after the direction from which they are blowing. There was a strong south wind that came up at that time, and the armada sailed fast up the coast of the north of England, up past Scotland, and the English fleet followed them as about as far as Scotland, and then just turned around and came home. There was nothing more they could do to them, and nothing more they needed to be done. North of Scotland, the Armada turned west and was navigating in unfamiliar seas without out of sight of land. And their plan was to, okay, here's Cornwall, here's Wales, on up there, and here's an exact representation of Ireland. It is shaped like a potato. The fleet was to sail this far and come down here and back to Spain. But their navigation was faulty, and they ended up sailing about like this right here. And many of the ships were crashed along the rocky shores of Ireland, rather than sailing smoothly out here in the open ocean. Eventually, about 50 out of the 150 ships made it back to Spain. No, let me give a better figure. 67 out of the 151 ships made it back to Spain, all badly damaged. The men who had embarked, remember, they were 8,000 sailors, 1,800 soldiers, making 26,000 men, and about 10,000 survived to get back to Spain. Well, that's kind of encouraging to me. I remembered most of that correctly without looking at my notes. Has any of you learned some things about this that you'd like to point out, or do any questions about this process arise in your mind at this point? What a good question. I think there was a scene about that on a documentary that I watched, but I don't remember. Have you ever heard anything about that?
I read a historical fiction book. I'm not sure. I think it's pretty accurate. It was a while ago, I think it said that the Irish actually killed them all, and they were like really afraid again.
As soon as you asked that, that's what came to my mind. Didn't the Irish kill them? But I couldn't remember what I had learned about that. Have you heard that?
When she asked that, I was thinking, I remember that the Irish just basically killed them all.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have here in my notes, the defeat of this armada, which was largely by the weather. You know, by the time the Battle of Gravelines happened, and then the armada headed north, really, the armada still had most of its ships and most of its men. The real destruction of the armada was by the weather and the ocean. The defeat of the Armada, largely by the weather, was regarded by Protestants all over Europe as God's deliverance of his people from the Roman Catholics. There was a famous statement, "God breathed and they were scattered," the main reference being to the strong south wind that came up that meant the end of the Armada's plans for invading England. It's interesting that this treble clef from a previous class has ended up looking a little bit like maybe a nose for this person, with a very prominent chin or goatee. So the reason that I'm having this class for you is, I enjoy it tremendously. The reason I'm having this class for you is so that you can know what God has done for us. You know how in the Bible that was often brought up? You know what God has done for us. Now tell your children about it, and tell your children so they can tell your grandchildren about it. So that then you can give glory to God, you can fear Him and not man, you can trust in Him instead of in yourselves or anything about this world. And understanding what happened with the Spanish Armada, King Philip II of Spain, Queen Elizabeth, and England, I think helps you with all of that. Not as much as reading about how God saved Noah and his family from the flood in the time of the ark, not as much as knowing how God took Moses and Israel through the Red Sea on dry ground and drowned Pharaoh's army, not as much as knowing about how God took only 300 men with Gideon, and when they revealed their lamps and blew their trumpets, the Midianites all killed each other. And those are the God-inspired biblical events that have been recorded for us to know to fear God and not men, and to trust Him and that kind of thing. That doesn't mean we can't we can make similar observations from history. Right here is a person who is defending all of these congregations. They have been separated from the dominion of the Pope in Rome. And there is a powerful king just right here who wants to impose that allegiance to the Pope, that Antichrist religion, wants to impose it back on all of these congregations here. Now, and so here's this woman, Elizabeth I, and I don't vouch for anything about her character or faith in Christ or anything, but I can observe that she took seriously her role as head of state, who's supposed to secure the country against foreign invasion, supposed to secure the people's right to worship the Lord according to the Bible instead of having to worship Him according to how the Pope does and everything. And she and the people she was leading, they prayed, they called on the name of God and said, God defend us, and they took up arms and fought or were ready to fight, and the Lord blessed them. And that right there is a big part of why here we all are today, and we're having a religious school here that we don't have to have a license from the government. We don't have to ask for a license from the government that won't be granted. On the Lord's Day we go and we're Baptists and we won't sprinkle babies and we whatever, and that's we're free to do that. We have Bibles and we can read the Bible in English. We can read the Bible. We can read it in English. We can study it in Hebrew and Greek. We can study it in Latin. We can read an old Bible like the Geneva Bible if we want to. We can read a brand new Bible if we want to, and whatever else. And why is it like that? Why is it that when ships sailed carrying settlers to North America in the 1600s, why is it that they sailed carrying Geneva Bibles with them and King James Bibles with them to go settle the continent and know the gospel and raise up cities, you know, with official trust in God and all. Why is it that all that happened instead of England being part of the Roman Catholic conquest thing? You know, the stories that we have read, you know, that primary source material we got from those men who traveled and were among the Spanish and especially also French Roman Catholic settlements, you know, where they go in and they say, you know, would you like to be Roman Catholic or shall we kill you, you know, and the, you go, remember, you go put a cross on your main building and you start learning these things that we tell you in Latin and you don't know what they mean. As long as you do all of those, then we won't kill you. You know, that's why that things went so differently in North America from how they went in Central and South America under the Spanish. Largely because of what happened those few days when the Lord blew. And what would you all like to ask or add along those lines? Anything? So, for next week, the next chapter in the book is the doing of Elizabeth's sailors after the Armada, but I don't think I'm going to spend any more time on that with you. So for the reading this week, would you please read the, not the next chapter in the book, but the one after, the great drama of the Stuart period. The great drama of the Stuart period. And look over your notes from this class and thank the Lord for what He's done for us. That's all for now, friends. Thank you.